Welcome to Geopolitics Decanted. I'm Dmitry Alperovich, chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator, a geopolitics think tank in Washington, D.C. And today my guest is Bill Hennigan, a national security opinion writer for the New York Times, who has just produced The Brink, a terrific multi-part series for the paper focused on nuclear threats and the challenges our world faces in combating proliferation. Not to be confused, by the way, with the title of my own book, World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. It comes out next month and argues that we are unquestionably in Cold War II with China and outlines our comprehensive grand strategy for victory and what victory even means in this new Cold War. The book is available on pre-orders now on Amazon and all your favorite bookstores. Please check it out. But Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So Bill, I was really fascinated by your pieces. You have a couple out in the paper right now. And the first one talks about and reveals some really stunning details about what was happening just about a year ago in the fall of 2022 when the Russians were in danger and ultimately did lose the city of Kherson that they were occupying, of course, and how the U.S. national security establishment was incredibly concerned about the risk that Putin would retaliate with nuclear weapons against Ukrainian forces, particularly if that grouping of forces that they were ultimately able to evacuate from Kherson across the river were to be lost in the city. And the intelligence community was putting the risk of Russians using a nuclear weapon at 50-50, an incredibly high percentage and really probably the highest that we've had since in the last 60 years since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So talk about what you've uncovered and the details behind both the assessment and what the U.S. was doing in response.
Yeah, that's right. When I first heard that assessment, you know, I nearly fell out of my chair. You know, it was quite stunning. And as you set it up, I mean, the fear was there were thousands of Russian soldiers and they were being encircled by Ukraine. And the feeling was within the intelligence community that if Ukraine continued to have success, that Russia would have to act in order to stop them. And there was a reading that, you know, this would align with their stated doctrine, right? Because so many lives were at stake. And seeing this, the U.S. government snapped into action. There were numerous attempts to get the logistic lines moving well in advance, meaning getting supplies there, radiation monitoring equipment to be able to collect debris and store it so it could be analyzed here in the United States by the national labs.
And that was important because the fear was that Russians would try to create a false flag because they were also making threats about a dirty bomb supposedly being prepared to be used by the Ukrainians, right? So it was really important to actually attribute the attack to the Russians and not the Ukrainians.
Precisely. I mean, you may remember there was like this flurry of phone calls that occurred between the Russians and the United States. Shoigu was making a number of calls both to his American counterpart, Lloyd Austin, at the Pentagon, as well as other NATO allies, defense chiefs, talking about this dirty bomb, which you know, the reading was in the United States that this was all, you know, subterfuge, of course, for a Russian dirty bomb themselves or a tactical nuclear weapon, which, as your listeners probably know, is a lower yield, shorter range weapon rather than the H city busting H bombs that we know. And so all of this was just, as you point out, the highest point of concern for nuclear use since World War II.
So, you know, I remember that moment well, and I myself was quite skeptical that the Russians would actually use a nuclear weapon on Ukrainian forces because their doctrine actually states that nuclear weapons would only be used in a first strike scenario when the state itself is threatened, not just when a group of your forces is in danger. But I did think that the risk was quite high of a nuclear test, perhaps a detonation in the Black Sea as a warning sign to NATO, to the United States, that unless it restrained the Ukrainian forces, things could escalate quite more significantly. Did you hear about that possibility being assessed?
It was more that if there was going to be a catastrophic collapse of Russian forces, you know, that could be seen as an existential issue for Putin. And that was the understanding. And if they were going to be able to punch through the lines in the east, they may turn south and make a run for Crimea and cut the land bridge there. So with all that at stake, the thinking within the government was, you know, there are extreme lengths that he's going to be willing to go to in order to ensure that that does not occur.
And what were they, other than trying to send people to Poland, send detectors, radiation detectors and the like, and preposition supplies, what else were they thinking about? You talk about this Tiger team that was set up in the White House by Jake Sullivan to think through the options, right?
As you know, this the threat of nuclear escalation has been at the forefront of the administration since the beginning. And, you know, indeed, 4 days after the invasion in February of 22, Jake Sullivan directed a formation of a Tiger team within the White House to be able to come up with a playbook of sorts of options for the president to choose, you know, based on different contingencies. So, you know, that work started right away. And I know that within, you know, a matter of months, they were able to put together something meaningful for the president. By this time in the fall, they had already worked through a number of different scenarios.
Do you know what those scenarios are?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, this would be a dirty bomb, for instance. If a dirty bomb was used, you know, what's the equipment that we need to get there? What is the diplomacy pathways that we should push? What are the military options? You know, you couldn't go down the line, right? Say it was a strategic weapon. What if it was a tactical nuclear weapon? You know, the yield I understand it to be the concern of a yield was in the single kiloton range. So a relatively small nuclear weapon, and, you know, smallest in quotes. When you're talking about kilotons, you're talking about thousands of tons of TNT. And you know, the largest conventional weapon in the U.S. arsenal is the GBU 43, the mother of all bombs. You may remember that being used several years ago against an ISIS tunnel complex in Afghanistan. And that's only, that's only 11 tons of TNT. And so when you're talking even about a half of a kiloton, you're talking about a weapon that's on the order of 50 times larger. So it kind of, you know, we talk about these things in terms of like being small or low yield or tactical, non-strategic, but these weapons are of magnitudes that it's really hard to kind of wrap your head around.
But it's still, you know, when you look at the battlefield in Ukraine, the forces on both sides are fairly dispersed, right? There are numerous lines of attack. On both sides, they're attacking in relatively small formations. You don't have this combined army that's marching across the terrain. You'd best have companies, maybe battalions on the Russian side doing the attacks. So even if you use like a single tactical weapon, you're not going to destroy the Ukrainian military. So the primary purpose is really one to scare the Ukrainians, to scare the world that you have just crossed the Rubicon and, you know, you've used one, but, you know, more could come now that you've unleashed it, right?
You're absolutely correct. This was not going to turn the tide. This is not going to be a military, you know, win in the eyes of the intelligence, right? This was a weapon of terror. This was, you know, to signal to the world that there are, you know, I am willing to go at all lengths to win this conflict. And, you know, the 79-year taboo that we have on nuclear use is strong. And indeed, you know, the the White House made a diplomatic push, right, bilaterally, but it also worked through allies, adversaries, and third parties to be able to deliver that message to Putin and Putin's government.
So that is a really interesting point, right? And there was some coverage of that around that time, that we were reaching out to China, we were reaching out to India to send a message to Russia, do not do this, right? Because breaking that taboo would not just have a complete change of dynamics on the Ukrainian battlefield and may trigger an escalation in that region, but would also break the taboo globally, where China would not necessarily want to see that, India would not want to see that, right? There's a lot of countries with stakes, important stakes, in not seeing nuclear weapons being used in their own regions and keeping this taboo going for hopefully forever, but certainly much, much longer beyond the 70 plus years you talk about, right?
Well, right. And that's kind of why I framed the story, the essay, as I did, because, we talk about this, smaller weapon, so on and so forth, but the ripple on effects. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of loose talk around nuclear weapons now. There's, not only do you have Putin's implicit and explicit threats that he's made, in this government writ large, you've also seen Kim Jong-un's, once every few weeks, there's a new threat from him. And even President Trump, fire and fury. It just seems to be there's a lot of looser talk when it comes to the threat of these weapons. But what I try to convey through, both the physical description that I was able to, to have through studies and interviews that I did with survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I also was able to glean from, years and years back studies that have been done about, economic and environmental fallout effects of a nuclear weapon use. These things everything would change on a dime. New York stock market would likely halt trading. Aviation trade would be affected. And then there's the fear itself of having radiation contamination come through through trade through food and agriculture and these sorts of things. And so even though it's just one weapon, it has this cascading domino effect.
So you actually have an interesting line in the article. You say nuclear war is often described as unimaginable, but in fact it's not imagined enough, right? And you cite this study that was really interesting, that even if just 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs, which were very small, less than 1% of the estimated global nuclear arsenal, were to be detonated in certain cities, that aside from the damage to those cities, you could generate so much airborne soot that would darken the skies and lower global temperatures, maybe solve global warming, but not in the way you want to, and would actually cause the largest worldwide famine in history, right?
Yeah, that was from a study that was released 2 years ago. These, and that's the problem too with, even if there's one bomb used, there's got to be a tit for tat response, right? And I was told that, in all likelihood, the response, Ukraine is a kind of an unique case, because if, Ukraine, of course, is not a treaty ally with the United States. And, it's not a nuclear nation. And, the response to Ukraine, would most likely be, outside of the nuclear realm. But, if it is two nations that are nuclear, like we've seen, India and Pakistan, for instance, where, there was a wayward missile that was launched, fairly recently. And if these, that's all that happened in a non-crisis time. But imagine if there was a crisis at that period, and that was misinterpreted. It was an accident, an honest accident by everything we understand. But if there was this sort of response back and forth, even the detonation of what are we consider now smaller weapons, 100 of these smaller weapons, could have these catastrophic effects all over the globe. It's so it's so, you know, we've kind of put this into the realm of abstraction, you know, in terms of, well, nuclear use, it will not happen, you know, and just because it hasn't happened for the past eight decades doesn't ensure the fact that it will happen for the next eight.
Yeah, and, you know, the response to a nuclear weapon being used in this war that Russia is waging on Ukraine is so difficult, right? Because, of course, as you say, not only is Ukraine not a treaty ally, but we have not extended our nuclear umbrella even to some treaty allies, right? Certainly, we've said that to Germany, for example, and some others, that we will use nuclear weapons to protect them. So we will treat an attack on Berlin as if it were an attack on the United States. Of course, a lot of questions about whether we would really do that. It would be ultimately the decision of the president at the time, whether to respond. But if you think about just even conventional response, military response on Russia in response to a nuclear weapon being used on Ukraine, you're sort of bringing a knife to a gunfight, right? When you imagine a scenario, Russia has used a nuclear weapon, let's say on Ukrainian forces, it has shown the willingness to use this ultimate terrifying weapon, and you're going to respond conventionally to them, right? It just seems like it may not be the smartest idea. Certainly, you have a range of sanctions, diplomatic isolation, like all slew of options like that. But from a military perspective, you've got really, really challenging set of options there to consider.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the Russian calculus, you know, of course, is the United States, but really the global response that they received, I feel like that was the most meaningful. I mean, China has been sitting by and hasn't had, you know, any direct criticism, you know, the tacit support for the campaign. But I think when they stepped out and actually, you know, articulated, you know, this cannot happen, that was a real kind of sign that, you know, the lifelines that you have out there, the economic lifelines and so forth, that can be cut off as well. So, yeah, I mean, we often think about these things in terms of military responses and that. And I think, you know, for good reason, because, you know, it's existential, right? We're all at risk with these when it becomes nuclear. But I, you know, there's also other factors at play and outside of the U.S.-Russia dynamic.
Well, yeah. And if you look at sort of outside of the immediate conflict, in general, as you write, the risk of both nuclear proliferation, but also the risk of nuclear threats has been rising dramatically since the end of Cold War, Cold War One, as I call it in my book. You have arms control that is failing, right? You have the New START Treaty being suspended, of course, since the start of this war. And it itself expires in 2026. There's no negotiations right now between the U.S. and Russia to try to create a new agreement. You have the U.S. pulling out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2002, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in 2019, after we accused Russia of cheating on it. And even if you look at other states, you have India just this week announcing that has developed the MIRV capability, multiple independently targeted, targetable reentry vehicles. It is expanding its plutonium production. China is undergoing a massive arms buildup of going from about 300 nuclear weapons to over 1,000 that the Pentagon estimates by the end of the decade. Pakistan is improving their ballistic missiles, expanding nuclear production facilities, not to mention Iran and their continued efforts to enrich and be a threshold nuclear power. So the world is much more dangerous than I think most people tend to think about from a nuclear risk perspective, right?
Yeah, that's quite a list. And, you know, and that's right. That's kind of the foundational cornerstone for this entire series, which is, you know, we thought this problem was basically solved. You know, if not solved a lot, you know, it was basically a problem from the past. Nuclear issues, you know, since 9/11, terrorism has replaced that, you know, as being the number one national security concern. But all the while, this threat has not gone away. And in fact, it's gotten worse. You know, we're a generation removed from people really spending a lot of time and their, you know, effort really to thinking about nuclear weapons, you know. Can you imagine that in 1982, there were a million people in Central Park in New York City, largest activist protest at the time, for the global freeze movement to freeze nuclear the nuclear numbers on the United States and Russia in place. That sort of thing is completely not. We're not even anywhere close to that. And I think about this in terms of like global warming, right? If you walked out, you know, your front door and you stopped a stranger on the street, I think somebody could describe to you the broad contours of global warming, what that is. If you did the same thing and asked them about nuclear weapons and, you know, how many we have, you know, this sort of thing, I don't think that, you know, most people just don't know. And you know, don't take my word for it. You know, the Chicago Council, they released a study last year, I believe. You know, 60% of people admitted that they didn't know about nuclear weapons but wanted to know more about them. And, you know, this the guardrails that you and I grew up in, you know, during the Cold War of, like, you know, all of these, you know, series of agreements that, you know, kind of turned down the temperature between the United States and Russia and could put ceilings on the number of weapons, or, you know, in the case of INF, as you point out, you know, identified mutually menacing weapons and just eliminated that class altogether, those have all unwound. And so, you know, now, and the prospect of new agreements are which take years, months and years to hammer out the details of, haven't even begun. And now we have an introduction of a third great power when it comes to nuclear weapons in China. You know, they're estimated to have 1,000 by decade's end. You know, what does that look like? That strategic balance is been messed with as well.
And, you know, not only do you have people sort of not worrying about nuclear weapons, but I found it really interesting over the last 2 years that some in this country and in Europe have been talking very cavalierly about the prospect of escalation. In fact, some pretty serious people have been even saying, well, maybe the Russian weapons don't even work. Well, I'd rather not find out, and I'm pretty sure that the Russians are spending quite a bit of money and effort to make sure that those weapons do work, and they have thousands of them. They don't need that many to work to cause a really bad situation for the entire globe, as you write. So it seems like even in the Western societies, the threshold for thinking about nuclear war has come down rapidly. Again, something that was unimaginable during the Cold War as this really horrific thing. Now, and sort of like, well, maybe we shouldn't worry about it, at least expressed in some parts of society, right? Pretty remarkable. But, you know, you have another piece in the paper as well, which looks at the United States at this point, and you make an argument that our decision-making process for launching nuclear weapons, which resides solely in the hands of the President of the United States, is outdated. Tell us why.
Right. So the whole... First of all, when it comes to nuclear weapons, it's basically we have a nuclear monarchy. You know, the President of the United States, those are his or her weapons. No one else gets to make that call. And, you know, the whole system was set up after World War II. I mean, you know, Truman's the one that established this, which is that only the president can make the call to use nuclear weapons. And, you know, that made sense in the, you know, the early Cold War, when technology was not that great in terms of early detection systems, and you know, you didn't want to delegate the responsibility, you know, down to a lower officer level to use a nuclear weapon, because then it puts, you know, all of humanity at risk. So, you know, that power was vested in the White House, and it has remained that way. You know, the thinking behind it is that, you know, If there is signs that there's a nuclear weapon being used, or a nuclear weapon has been deployed, that the president needs to you know, this can't be you know, a meeting where everybody's voice is heard, right? We need to act definitively. We need to act right away and be able to respond.
Because the time matters, right? You may have 15, 20 minutes to make a decision.
Exactly, right? You know, you can't take a vote at the table. You know, anybody with a spouse or can tell you it takes a while to hammer out where you're going to go to dinner. You know, what do you want for dinner? Let alone, are you going to launch a nuclear strike? So that is, it stayed that way. And I agree. You know, I think that that makes good sense, right? Because it takes 30 minutes for an ICBM to be launched on one side of the world and land on the other side, which means that you got about, you know, 15 minutes to actually determine what you want to do before you send the order out to the field and to your nuclear forces and respond. Okay. That makes sense, right? You don't want a lot of cooks in the kitchen on something like that. But when it comes to, you know, the first use of a nuclear weapon, a president has unilateral decision-making authority on that, you know, and the president can call up and tell, you know, the nuclear forces, you know, through various verification, you know, they make sure it's him or her, so on and so forth. And then the president can issue that order. And, you know, we think, you know, that a senior military officer would step in and make the decision, oh, well, you know, we can't do this. Say it was an illegal order, right? That it came out of the blue. But, you know, there's no legal authority for any senior officer to make such a to make such a move. And, you know,
well, they have a right and indeed an obligation to refuse an illegal order, right? So that's ingrained in the law.
This is true, but you know, when the former STRATCOM U.S. Strategic Command commander General Keeler was in front of Congress, you know, he was asked about this because, you know, you may remember, I think it was 2017. This is you know, the height of concern between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. You know, it almost become personal at that point where they're, you know, ridiculing, you know, like a schoolyard, you know, brawl or something. Anyway, the question was tossed to the general about, well, what if this order was made? He said, well, there's, you know, we have all these sorts of ways to checks and balances. And he says, well, I'm still not hearing you. If a president made the order to make this strike, what would you do? And he couldn't provide an answer. He noticeably got uncomfortable in his seat, and he said, well, thankfully these are all hypothetical scenarios. Well, they may be hypothetical now, but you know, I cover the military for years. They plan for all sorts of hypotheticals. That's what the building does. So I think it's only natural or only makes good sense for the Congress to just put into law that no president can make the decision to use a nuclear weapon first in any skirmish without, you know, the sign-on by, you know, maybe two members of his cabinet, or, you know, I'm open to senior members in Congress if necessary as well. But, you know, no single person should have that power to launch a nuclear war, at least in our country.
So let's debate that a little bit. But first of all, I want to point out that the situation may not be black and white. It may not be that, oh my God, a strike is imminent, or that there's no tensions whatsoever between us and country X and the president, you know, maybe in a drunken stupor, as was happening with Nixon on quite a few occasions, not with regards to nuclear weapons use, but with regards to some decision-making he was allegedly trying to make, and particularly in the latter parts of his presidency, may decide to launch a strike out of the blue on that country, right? But you may also have a situation where you have an incredible amount of tension, you know, maybe forces build up, etc., and the president decides in that scenario, I want to strike first, which is much more of a gray line, right? Whether it's a legal order or not, if the president believes that, you know, there's a threat to the United States. And I want to push you back on this argument a little bit. And presumably this is one of the reasons why you haven't seen any changes to this law that grants the president with this unilateral decision-making power, is because there's lots of scenarios you can imagine where it is a first strike situation, but the time is short, right? For example, we have advance warning that, let's say, China is about to launch a nuclear attack on, let's say, our forces in Guam or Okinawa or whatever. And the only way to stop that is with a first strike of our own, regardless of whether you think that's a smart idea or not. But you will not have time to go to Congress or assemble a cabinet. You know, you may not have 15 minutes, but maybe less than an hour, right? And the time is short, and you want a president to have that level of flexibility. What do you say to that?
Well, I as I say in the in the essay, you know, in such a scenario like you lay out, and of course, you know, the sort of things that we dream up almost are never the likely thing to occur. It's most likely going to be a gray area, like you point out. And as I say in the essay, my feeling is that, you know, even if that scenario, that information is likely going to be given to the president through senior members of his cabinet, like a Secretary of Defense, like a Joint Chiefs chairman, and or the Secretary of State, right? And I know through covering, you know, through national security coverage, that these sorts of consultations, they can happen very rapidly. So, you know, if that's the case, and the chairman is going to give his or her advice to the president, it only makes sense that for him or her to also have some skin in the game and say, yes, I consent to this use. This is all happening tacitly anyway. But having a vote on the record seems to make good sense. Probably going to Congress makes it a little bit more complicated, and certainly the situation that you're laying out. But when you have a national security emergency, you know, you're likely going to surround yourself with the best advice that you can. And those people should also give a thumbs up or thumbs down about the use of a nuclear weapon.
So it's interesting because presumably in a scenario like that, that would happen naturally anyway. I can't imagine at least most presidents making that decision without asking at least the people in the room, do you think we should do this, right? This is a pretty momentous decision. So I could see codifying it, you know, helping and making sure that that actually happens, but it probably would anyway. And the challenge of trying, of course, to restrain the president's authority on this is that the president has enormous authority within the executive branch anyway. So let's say you're the Secretary of Defense that says, no, we will not launch a nuclear weapon. Well, the president can fire you on the spot at that point, right? So doesn't it become very, very difficult to actually constrain presidential power here?
Well, I agree. This is stuff that already occurs, you know. So why not just make it, you know, permanent, right? Where you can't. This should just be the law. We should not have to say, oh, well, this is something that occurs, and let's just ensconce it into law. In terms of people being fired on the spot, yeah, I think there's a way to, you should have to say that there are about, you know, five of these officials and at least two of them need to sign off, something like that. I guess you could go even further into say, you know, what if the president fired them all? I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't write legal language, but I'm sure that there's a way to make this a reasonable a thing. I mean, I'm trying to think of other powers that work like this, but I think there is a way to get at that without making it that the president can just wholesale fire his cabinet off.
You're right in the piece that this is not a new idea. It's been considered in some form of fashion since the 1970s. Do you think the reason that it hasn't moved forward is not just because of the complexity of figuring out exactly the details of making this work, but because people just don't like to think about this unthinkable prospect of a nuclear weapons use? And they, you know, we've had this culture at the beginning of the Cold War, the first Cold War, in the 50s and 60s, where there was a lot of detailed planning on how we would use nuclear weapons, how they would be survivable, the whole thinking about first strike, counter force, counter value, etc. And we seem to have shied away from that, and most people seem to psychologically just want to put it out of their mind and not think about it. Do you think that that's the case, that we have just changed in our thinking about nuclear weapons, where this is so horrific that we just don't want to spend time thinking about it, even policymakers?
Yes, I think that there is a, you know, what motivated most of the most novel and meaningful thinking on nuclear weapons was fear. You know, the fear of their use inspired people to come up with solutions about, you know, be it arms control or, you know, deterrence theories, you know, that was the motivating factor behind all of that. And because, you know, for the last 25 years, we've not thought about them very, very much, you know, we're not fearful of, you know, being nuked tomorrow, like it was, like that palpable fear during much of the Cold War, you know, that's kind of made it easier not to do anything. And I do think that, you know, there is a big, you know, there's a feeling that, well, it hasn't happened, you know, for the past 80 years. So what makes you think anything's going to be any different? And, you know, I think time and again, things have shown us that things are, you know, things can happen that you can't anticipate. And, you know, that's why we're writing this. This is why we're embarking on this, to put in front of people to highlight to them, you know, this is something that we need to be thinking about. We need to demand new thoughts from our politicians. And, you know, how many presidential elections have we watched where, you know, the topic of nuclear weapons doesn't even come up? Or if it does, it's a, you know, kind of an accident. It's not on purpose. We should demand this sort of conversation to take place, because, you know, the nuclear situation is rapidly changing. And, you know, we keep handing this problem off to a new generation, and now it's been handed to us, and it's worse. So, you know, we need fresh thinking on this.
Last question. In the last month, you've had this amazing story that came out about Russia preparing to put potentially nuclear weapon into space, presumably to generate an EMP effect that would destroy many of the satellites, particularly U.S. based satellites, but really all satellites in orbit. Unclear exactly why they may want to do this, whether it's to take out U.S. Capabilities. Of course, it would also take out Russian capabilities and Chinese and many others. But, you know, one direct implication of that would be that it would take out also the satellites that we use to track nuclear weapons launches, right? We're highly, highly reliant on satellite-based, orbit-based systems to detect a strike and provide enough warning to the president to make a decision on what to do. And that could make the world much more dangerous, aside from sort of destroying satellites in orbit, affecting our intelligence capability, communications capability, and the like, that from a nuclear risk perspective, this can make the world incredibly dangerous. Have you spent any time looking at that story?
Yes, of course. I mean, I spent a lot of time with U.S. Space Command, U.S. Space Force over the years. You know, before that, when it was mostly Air Force personnel attached to it. And, you know, I've been hearing for years about how China and Russia, you know, see the U.S. Reliance on space as an Achilles heel in a potential conflict. Because, you know, it's not only, you know, communications, it's navigation, it's precision strike, right? You know, weapons, you know, our smart bombs are smart because of the space based navigation to the target. And you know, so there's been fears for many years about what that was, why the Space Force was stood up. You know, some people still laugh, friends of mine do, about the Space Force, but the truth is that space has become a contested domain. There are already, you know, weapons, you know, there are satellites that can maneuver and grapple other satellites and move them out of orbit. There are satellites that can blind our intelligence gathering satellites. And, you know, this has all inspired a whole new thinking about how we deploy satellites in outer space. You know, I used to cover the aerospace industry in Los Angeles, and I would go and I would see that. Well, I did see the GPS satellites that were being built, but not the spy satellites. But these are, you know, these were school bus sized satellites. You know, you go in there and you know, they look up at the thing, it's just towering, and oh my goodness, all the work that goes in there, years and years, billions of dollars go into this one thing. Well, now they're trying to, you know, diversify the satellite, make them shoebox size and deploy them in mass, as we've seen with Starlink. So they're less of a target of a sitting duck because of the new capabilities that have been developed over the years. It's a petrifying idea because of the way that we live our life. I mean, it's not just the military, it's you and me. We rely on satellites for everything that we do. You know, Wall Street trades are tied to GPS. When we get ATM, money's out of the ATM, you know, that's tied to GPS, and, you know, pumping gas, GPS as well, things we just don't even think about. And so, you know, when you have the prospect of a weapon like this, but deployed in the space, it is, you know, it's a big deal. It's not something that should be laughed about. And I don't live too far from Annapolis, and I know that they're training young officers now on celestial navigation, you know, for the first time in decades, because of our over reliance on satellites and you know, the prospect that you know, that's not guaranteed into the future.
But aside from all those really important use cases, the one that I'm very concerned about is the impact on our ability to see the preparation for a nuclear strike, right? Because both our optical satellites that could detect sort of the fueling of ICBMs or the movements of mobile launchers, as well as the specialized sensors we have to actually detect a launch of a missile, that's what we're relying on to figure out, you know, our entire nuclear response option, how much time the president would have, the list of capabilities we would use in response. If that is gone, if we're back sort of to the 1950s world where we're essentially blind and we don't know when someone may have launched at us, that creates a much more dangerous world where countries would, you know, not just us, but everyone would be in the same boat, would be on a much more hair trigger alert and perhaps more willing to launch as a first strike because their fear is that their arsenal could be taken out without them knowing.
Completely agree with you. I mean, it's highly destabilizing. The heat signature, we can, you know, the U.S. can see the heat signature of any ballistic missile that's launched in the globe. I mean, that's DSP. You know, that's all out of Colorado, and you're completely correct. So, and that's why, you know, when they were talking, you know, there's just North Korea established its first satellite in the space, and, you know, that, you know, might not have the high fidelity that the United States has, but I feel like it's a highly stabilizing thing for any nuclear nation to be able to have an idea of what their adversaries are doing. Where everyone benefits from something like that. You might not like it, but it's, as you point out, it's a highly stabilizing thing to be able to ensure that what your adversary is doing. And if your adversary is saying, you know, like the New START agreement with all the verification measures that had, it was providing metadata between the United States and Russia about, you know, maintenance work on ICBM silos and their bombers. And you know, you were able to verify that through, you know, your intelligence gathering means. Say they were saying they were doing something, you were observing it. In the absence of that, you know, you have to assume the worst on your adversary. So I couldn't agree more with what you just said.
All right. The series is called At the Brink. Please check it out in the New York Times. Thanks so much for coming on.
I really liked it, Dimitri. Thank you.